We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Do you ever feel like you're always on? What do you do when you need a moment to chill? How do you like to hit the reset button to get ready for what's next? These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nothing but nonstop hustle all the time. With working from home and trying to stay in touch with friends and family, a million pressing social issues, and an expectation to always be on 24/7. Sometimes you just need a moment to turn off and hit reset. That's when you reach for Coors Light. It's made to chill. My moment to chill is watching baseball, especially when the White Sox are on. I like to have a Coors Light beside me. It's a great beer to have watching the games, as it's cool and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. And even the mountains on my cans turn blue, telling me that it's time to hit reset. Sit back, relax, and hunker down for an evening of White Sox baseball. So when it's time for you to unwind, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Must be 21 years or older to enjoy. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado. And as always, celebrate responsibly.
From your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Memorial Day, Monday, May 31st, 2021. On this episode, we recap the home series against the Baltimore Orioles, as the White Sox completed the bum slaying by sweeping the O's in four games. The Chicago White Sox are now 32-20 as they make their way to Cleveland, which they will have another doubleheader to play on Monday. We'll preview that series, report on the happenings down in the minor leagues, and answer your questions in P.O. Sox. Joining me now is the managing editor of SoxMachine.com and the co-host of the podcast, it's Jim Margulis. And hello, Jim. The White Sox had a great Memorial Day weekend. Did you?
I did, partially because the White Sox had a great Memorial Day weekend, and also because it cooled down, so got a respite from heat and humidity. The chief is all healed up from his surgery, so able to go to the dog park. Enjoyable weekend all around. How about you?
That's awesome. I'm glad that chief is feeling a lot better. Yeah, because that cone of shame is not fun for puppies. Memorial Day weekend was great. Thanks to vaccines and the wonder of science, we were able to have a housewarming party, which was fun, and it was great to see everyone. I had friends that had kids that this was the first time we got to see them because of the pandemic. So that was great. I got a chance to sit in the Goose Island gym. Our friend Ashley is visiting from Connecticut, so I decided, you know what, I'm going to splurge a little bit. I'm going to get us seats in the Goose Island, get a chance to experience sitting there. And I have to say, you wouldn't buy season tickets there, but if you are having friends or family and you want to have a special occasion, I recommend it. It's a great view. The seats are pretty comfy. That USB outlet is pretty clutch. So your phone is always plugged in, and you can stay charged, so you don't have to worry about your phone dying. And having wait staff is nice, to have somebody come and bring you your beers or whatever food that you want. But we had a really good time until the sun went away and then it got really cold. It was a cold Memorial Day weekend in Chicago. But it was a fun time. It was a fun time. And I do recommend it, that if you haven't gotten a chance to sit in the Goose Island, to do it at least once, because you'll have a good time.
Yeah, I imagine it's got to be a benefit for people in the content game like us to have Charger right there in case we want to do any live reaction or kill some time or do Twitter spaces or what have you. But part of it, yeah, part of going to a game for me is putting the phone away for the most part and just keeping score. So not quite sure, like, if I want the temptation. I mean, it's handy, though, if I were going to a White Sox game specifically for that reason, to be able to respond and write and such. But going to a park, like, I kind of like it, it's kind of like when I go on planes, I like the opportunity to not plug in and to not have Wi-Fi. Like, if I have to pay for Wi-Fi, I don't. And I get by with books or, you know, stuff I've already downloaded. But it'd be handy for that, for just being able to talk, to be able to say, like, why are people yelling at Angel Hernandez when I can't see the strike zone? All those questions you can't get from a side angle.
Yeah, that was me, right? Because yeah. I was asking, like, why did the Baltimore Orioles catcher throw down to second? And I think you chimed in with the strike zone, like, well, because it was a strike. And I can't tell from the Goose Island. So I appreciate that. You know what? One thing that's changed my baseball viewing, I have YouTube TV. Mm-hmm. And when you are in the stands and it's a close play that doesn't appear to be going the White Sox way, they don't show replay of it at Guaranteed Rate Field. Mm-hmm. So I just go into YouTube TV, my app, because it's about a 10-second delay. And I just quickly bring up the game there and I get the TV broadcast feed on my phone. And then that's where I can, you know, see the replays while I'm at the stadium.
Okay.
So that's where it helped me to be plugged in via USB. But yeah, I was charging my phone for no reason, because it was kind of nice just to, you know, sit back, relax, you know, have a couple beers and watch the White Sox beat up on the Baltimore Orioles and stick around as far as being a straight doubleheader, just waiting 30 minutes for game two to start.
Yeah, how was that?
You know, I like it. If the shade didn't, you know, cause a huge drop in temperature, we probably would have stayed for game two. It got just too cold, and it was like, all right, we got to go back, and we got to let Frankie out. I like it. I know I've been saying this for a while. I know there are fans that absolutely hate it. I enjoy the seven-inning doubleheaders, and if you're going to do the seven-inning doubleheaders, I say do them back-to-back like that.
I don't like seven-inning split. I hate that.
Yeah, that's dumb.
Yeah.
Waiting, yeah, like, I think we're going to see this in Cleveland, which we'll preview the White Sox-Indians series later in the podcast. But I think on Monday, you're getting a 2:10 p.m. start, Central Time start, and I think, like, a 5 o'clock start. So maybe it's not that big of a difference as far as time. But yeah, if you're doing a 1 o'clock 7-inning game and then a 7 o'clock 7-inning game, that's stupid. You might as well just make those 9-inning games.
Yeah, I've seen the back-to-back games in the minors, and it's really handy for seeing all the players. Like, you know, some guys will get a game off here or there, and they'll get an excuse to sit down. But usually you see, like, all the position players you want to see, and then most of the relievers you want to see, too. So that's why I enjoy just seeing them back-to-back. And imagine for fans who maybe go to one or two games a year, you know, don't get there all that often, there's really not a chance of having your favorite player have the day off.
Yeah, and I think it's worthwhile to be in a stadium.
unless your favorite player is Zach Collins.
That's true. But it's worthwhile to be at a stadium then for 4.5 hours if you're getting 14 innings of baseball with, like, an intermission. Let's call it that. It felt like an intermission. Where you're getting 30 to 45 minutes to go get food or grab another beer because alcohol sales have resumed.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're going to do 7-inning doubleheaders, they should be straight doubleheaders.
We agree.
I think this is a philosophical topic when it comes to just everything in baseball. And it's, what do we learn from bum slaying in baseball? Because that's what happened this weekend. You have a contending team in the Chicago White Sox bum slay a Baltimore Orioles team that is going to be going on for 2 weeks before seeing their next win. They haven't won in 2 weeks. It's been a long time. And I think someone tweeted out that the Baltimore Orioles and the Arizona Diamondbacks are like 7-43 combined in the month of May. I mean, you just have teams nosediving right now, and the Baltimore Orioles are one of those teams. We've been doing this podcast for 8 seasons now, Jim. We have seen the White Sox be the bums that the contending teams were taking advantage of and beating them up for easy wins. But now the White Sox are good, and they are slaying the bums like Baltimore. So what do we learn from bum slaying, Jim, that helps you understand better about what we are watching when it comes to the White Sox game to game?
Well, you know, seeing the reaction from Yankees fans and writers to seeing the Yankees getting swept by the Tigers, who are coming in with the second worst record, coming in at series with the second worst record in the American League, and going and sweeping the Yankees, and the Yankees committed 3 errors and just basically got beaten by Tarek Skubal, and they were searching for answers, and Aaron Boone has nothing good to say to the reporters. Like, bum slaying is better than getting beaten by bums and having everybody bummed out as a result. So I'm all for it. Now, we talked about it before, and just it's very refreshing, not just in, you know, I guess for the simple reason of winning games they should win, but also just the idea of, you know, we've talked about it before, the idea of, like, when looking at the White Sox in a competitive division, in a competitive league, like, I'm thinking specifically like 2015, 2016, saying like, well, the White Sox are trying to break in. They have a better roster than previous years, but how are they going to get these wins? Like, how are they going to get to 85 wins? Like, who are, you know, where are these losses going to come from? And, you know, I mentioned that, you know, if you look around the table and don't know the sucker, it's you. And that's how it kind of felt when it came to the losses. Like, if you don't know who's going to be taking these losses, mm-hmm. who's going to be basically the other side of a zero-sum equation, then it's probably the White Sox, especially a White Sox team that still has, like, Robin Ventura and still has the Rick Hahn front office that couldn't sign free agents, all that sort of stuff. So this year, seeing them go into a Baltimore series like they did against Kansas City, taking on a team with a long losing streak and extending that losing streak to now a preposterous length, that's just, I think, very reassuring in terms of the quality of the team. And, you know, to follow up on the conversation we had previewing the series, like, I wanted to see them give Matt Harvey a hard time. They gave Matt Harvey a hard time. And that's kind of what I'm looking for. Like, just, you know, when they have weaknesses against a certain pitcher of certain handedness, or a pitcher is struggling, you know, bullpen struggling, a starting pitcher needs to get on a roll. Like, if they use these teams to accomplish those goals, that's fine. You know, it's superior to the alternative.
Yeah, in the last 10 games, the White Sox are 6-4. They had a really good week. I mean, they won 2 out of 3 against St. Louis. They swept Baltimore. It's a great homestand to go 6-1 in the 7 games. And then, of course, the other 3 losses come from the New York Yankees, as Jim just mentioned, that got swept by the Detroit Tigers. The one thing that I learned from this series is that the starting pitching for the White Sox is agnostic to who they are facing. Example is Lucas Giolito with the bases loaded situation to be able to navigate and get out of that jam and how pumped he was. Same thing with Lance Lynn. Lance Lynn getting super amped up. They are treating the Baltimore Orioles just like they were treating any team, especially like the Minnesota Twins or Cleveland
Dylan
this week.
Dylan Cease screaming.
Yeah, Dylan Cease showing emotion. That's something that I think is a good thing, that at times, like we just, like you mentioned with the Yankees, that's a really good example, Jim, because it seems like the Yankees took their foot off the gas. Gerrit Cole did not have a good start against Detroit, and maybe the Yankees go into Detroit thinking that, well, this is going to be an easy weekend, and lo and behold, they get swept, and now it's a terrible weekend for them. It's a great weekend if you're a Detroit Tigers fan, but if the White Sox starting pitching is going to treat every team that they're going to be facing as world beaters, and they're going to try to bring their A game, every single start out. That's how you make these series really one-sided, even though the offense isn't clicking at its potential for the White Sox at this moment. I mean, winning 3-1 ball games against Baltimore, okay, three runs is not a whole lot against this type of pitching, and it's not very good pitching for Baltimore. But if the White Sox rotation is going to continue to pitch at this level, Jim, I mean, where they're only giving up one run a game, then three runs seems like a lot.
And that's a good point. And I think that's partially the result of the stability the White Sox have had in the rotation. Like, aside from Lance Lynn missing a little bit of time and Dylan Cease had a brief COVID outage, they basically had everybody being able to make the starts on schedule every 5 days in the same order. And when you have the kind of role they're on, and this is a case, I think, where winning generates its own chemistry, I think there is a tendency or a natural outcome to where there's a little bit of one-upsmanship, or, you know, kind of like in bowling with the beer frame, like not wanting to be the guy who doesn't get the strike.
Yeah, great analogy.
Hold up his end and has to pay. Like, that's kind of how I look at it. And they've been basically knocking down every start. And to the point where, you know, the bullpen is rested enough to where Tony La Russa can pull Lance Lynn after five innings and basically count on, you know, I think he's hoping on two relievers, had to use three. But, you know, had the flexibility to say, you know, Lance Lynn could maybe go an inning or two more, but we want him for short rest so we can pull him back and have him go, you know, patch him into a start on Wednesday and be fine with it. So it produces results that I think allows some competition in the rotation, and it makes things a lot easier for bullpen planning, which begets better rotation planning, and there's just a whole lot of benefits all the way around.
Looking at starting pitchers with at least a minimum of 40 innings pitched to start 2021, Carlos Rodon and Lance Lynn are 1-2 leading the American League in ERA. The only starting pitcher in Major League Baseball that has a lower ERA pitching at least 40 innings is Jacob DeGrom. Like, when was the last time that happened where the White Sox had two starting pitchers, 1-2 in ERA?
I'm thinking like maybe...
was the 2005 rotation that good with Contreras when he got hot?
Are you talking about like four, like just chunks of a season?
Yeah.
Maybe like, I think Burley and Garland got off to a really good start, so maybe they started similarly.
Okay.
Before regressing a little bit. Or maybe they just... Yeah, I know Garland was on a hot streak when it came to wins, like piling up victories, but...
Yeah, but...
Let me look into that.
I love the beer frame analogy, though, because, yeah, Cease has a big game. It's my turn. I'm going to have a big game. Giolito's striking out 12. I'm going to go strike out 13. You know, I think it's this type of collaboration between the White Sox starting pitching staff that, again, I'm going to keep harping on this. We didn't have a lot of confidence in the White Sox starting pitching staff. I think anyone that covers the White Sox prior to 2021 would tell you that I think the weak point is going to be the starting pitching, and the offense is going to have to score a lot of runs to make up for some concerns in the number four and number five spots in the White Sox starting rotation. But right now, the guy that's buying beers in the beer frame, Jim, is Dallas Keuchel. I mean, and he's not pitching terribly. You know, Keuchel's being Keuchel. But if we're going to have Carlos Rodon as your number five starter, lead the league in ERA, Lance Lynn, the guy that you acquired before this season to help solidify the rotation, is number two. Lucas Giolito's had three straight great starts, and he's getting back on track. And Dylan Cease has got a below three ERA. If you're a White Sox fan right now and you're going to be writing to Jim and I, hey, does this have a 2005 similar feel? At least on the starting pitching staff, yeah. I mean, as a White Sox fan, you got to have a ton of confidence in every single game right now because of just the way the starting pitchers are going. They're going to give you 6-7 quality innings, and you're going to feel great for 6-7 innings as long as the offense scores three runs, and that's not a lot of runs.
Well, even like the Yankees series, which was a sweep, you know, losing all three, you know, two of the losses were walk-offs. And even then, like, even if you just treat a loss as a loss and don't give points or moral victories for margin, it's still like the only three-game losing streak they've had all year.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's impressive. And then to come back from that 3-game losing streak and win 6 of 7, that's terrific.
It is. So that's what I have learned from the bum slaying this weekend, is the White Sox starting pitching staff is agnostic to whomever they are facing. And that's a good mentality to have. And it's a great way to continue to stay in rhythm and to stay on track. But as Jim pointed out, the other option is being like the Yankees, taking the foot off the gas, and all of a sudden you're swept, and now you have a bigger deficit in your division as the Tampa Bay Rays are not slowing down. It's a good weekend for the White Sox, but I know there's been a lot of conversations of, well, Jake Lamb hit a home run. How does that impact Adam Engel? I don't know. Honestly, I don't know what we take away as far as, you know, Jose Abreu had a great weekend offensively, but Baltimore's pitching, it's bad, Jim. Like, they should have had a good weekend.
Yeah, although Jake Lamb, I think we can back off the jokes temporarily. Like, just being the reflexive.
You are buying Jake Lamb stock.
I'm not buying. It's a case where, like, yeah, I wrote about this on Sunday morning talking about Billy Hamilton after his homer and just the amount of support that Billy Hamilton has both in the dugout and in the stands. And after I wrote that, I heard a story about from Mr. Onorama on Twitter talking about how Billy Hamilton was just like making bets or like saying like, making friendly wagers or trying to have fans guess the outcome of certain at bats and such and interacting back and forth. So he's making fans along the dugout, making fans in center field. Tim Anderson's hyping him up and Tim Anderson, like, you know, what has been said about him, you know, being in Billy Hamilton's corner, not just, you know, in the dugout, but in the clubhouse, but in the dugout and even on the on deck circle, he is shouting encouragement. He's like the best friend you could ever have. But just seeing the kind of groundswell of support he's gotten. And then you see Jake Lamb having, you know, a big moment and helping swing a game with a homer. It's, you know, not necessarily something to buy, you know, and that's kind of how I'm looking at it. It's like, I don't know if it's true, but like it's better than the alternative, but it's better than him not producing. And it's also just kind of a product of right field. As long as Adam Engel doesn't really have functioning legs under him and is going to have an OPS that starts with 4 for an entire month, you got to have somebody standing in there. So whether it's, you know, Lamb doing it or Billy Hamilton doing it or Danny Mendick standing in, just whatever, you know, turns the day on the calendar over with a chance of contributing something is welcome. And to have Lamb, you know, having a, he's got a WRC plus, I think, of over 130 now. He's, you know, maybe he's bumslaying himself into contention, but at least he's doing something and is the better roster play than he looked like a week or two into the season.
My angst against Lamb, I will admit, is misplaced. I did a segment for ESPN 1000 on Sunday. And that's what I told Fred Huebner, is that I'm not satisfied with Jake Lamb. And if Jake Lamb, I tweeted this out, doesn't hit against Matt Harvey, you got to DFA him, because I don't know who Jake Lamb could hit if he's not going to be able to hit Matt Harvey. It's misplaced, because really it should be placed on Adam Eaton. Like the right field situation is very much unresolved, and we are heading into June, and I get it. Adam Eaton's got a hamstring issue, okay? But the White Sox need a little bit more power in this lineup. And if you think Jake Lamb could fake it well enough in right field, then maybe Jake Lamb should get more playing time just to be 100% sure. Because if Rick Hahn is set on having Adam Engel part of this 26-man roster, there's a somewhat difficult roster decision coming up. Unless it is, you know, already been foretold that Danny Mendick is going to be optioned back to Charlotte, because he's got options, and that's where Adam Engel comes into play. But you still got to play these guys. And if Adam Eaton is still not 100% healthy and you still need home runs against these righty pitchers, then go ahead. Give Jake Lamb more starts, more plate appearances. Because you need to start getting answers, like firm answers, because we're counting down the days, Jim, before the trade deadline starts. And with the teams nosediving right now, like we mentioned, like with the Arizona Diamondbacks, we're going to have a better idea on who's going to be selling real soon in the league.
Yeah, I'm going to have a post coming up, I think, on Tuesday, because that's the official past the halfway point to the trade deadline in the number of games before July 31st will pass the halfway point towards, you know, that date and that single trade deadline too. So, you know, August trades and transactions are a lot harder to swing. The thing I think will happen is that, you know, Danny Mendick would be the first guy down, but then maybe subject to Adam Eaton, whether he needs to go on the injured list or not, maybe Engel coming back is the way that Eaton goes on the injured list. Right now, he's kind of holding down a roster spot in case emergency breaks out. But, you know, he hasn't played in a couple days. The White Sox seem to have options coming to life, at least, you know, in spurts, like with, you know, Billy Hamilton's two homers in a row and Jake Lamb, you know, maybe doing some bum sling of his own. You know, maybe once Engel's back and provides another outfield option, maybe that's when Eaton takes a break. They'll have one Adam E. from Ohio in the outfield, and that's good enough. But if not, if Eaton's still stubborn, or everybody's around the White Sox is stubborn about Eaton being in the lineup or being on the roster, then it seems like Danny Mendick's just I think that's his role, to shuffle in and out of the rotation, because it seems like when he's when he gets any kind of regular run, yeah, there are diminishing returns. Yeah, just the production starts drying up, the walks start turning into strikeouts, pitchers are more aggressive facing him, so I think he's not a bad guy to send down and then bring back up, because when, you know, when he comes back up, you don't feel bad about it. You just feel bad about it when he, you know, starts accruing maybe three or four starts in a week.
So back to the Jake Lamb and Adam E. comparison. Adam Eaton in 113 at-bats against right-handed pitching this season is hitting .221 with a .338 on base percentage, and he's slugging .389. Jake Lamb in just 37 at-bats, so not many plate appearances this season, is hitting .216 with a .356 on base percentage and slugging .486. Like, if the White Sox need more power, to me, Jim, it makes more sense to have Jake Lamb in the lineup than Adam Eaton. But Adam Eaton's the better right fielder defensively. And
yeah,
and that's why he's going to be in the lineup. And, you know, maybe the White Sox were thinking, well, Jake Lamb can get DH opportunities. But yes, I'm sorry, Yermin Mercedes has tied down the DH spot. So that's kind of where my angst is. It was misdirected. It's really about the right field situation, because we're going into June and I still don't think it's a resolved position.
Yeah, I will say, you know, maybe I feel a little bit better about Lamb because he did show signs of life after going to Oakland last year in September. You know, it's small sample, is a small sample last year, small sample this year. But when you're looking at his last 30 games or 29 games, yeah, he's batting .250, OBP of .344, slugging percentage of .524 over about 100 plate appearances.
Okay.
So it's something. It's a production the White Sox can use. I don't mind seeing him in the lineup. I don't like seeing him in the corner spot, especially right field, because he looks very tentative out there. Like, he'd rather have anybody else take charge. And it's the kind of, you'd almost rather him take charge, even if he's not the best guy to catch a ball, just because when you have outfielders going back and outfielders or infielders going out, outfielders coming in, I think it's incumbent on the outfielder to call the infielder off, because the infielder tends to call himself off and cause more problems. So that's why I don't like seeing him in a corner spot. Like, he's just not well suited for it. But yeah, if they have to, if Adam Engel comes back, I think that'll help a little bit, and then just try to play him sparingly. But if that's the only place to play him and he's still showing a perfectly cromulent bat, then may as well, just while Adam Eaton is just, has no legs, basically.
All right. Before we get to your minor league report, there's one other item that I wrote down on a post-it note and I wanted to discuss with you. And that's the situation in center field. Who would you rather see get more playing time at the moment in center field, Billy Hamilton or Leury García?
To the extent that I care, I think Leury.
I'm kind of going more on the Billy Hamilton side.
I enjoy Hamilton being out there. I don't enjoy them. Like, basically, you know, we talked about it before that I just didn't like seeing them in the same lineup.
Right. And that happens often.
Yeah. So, and that's why I'm kind of pro Jake Lamb, or becoming more and more a Jake Lamb fan by the day. I'm in the Jake Lamb flock. I don't know.
You're in the flock.
But just, yeah, just because he prevents that. And, you know, when they're both contained to center field and they're both okay plays in center field for an emergency, especially like Billy Hamilton, like, serves a purpose. Like, he can go and get him in center. And if he's batting eighth or ninth and his job is to run down fly balls, basically, and the other eight hitters in the lineup are expected to do the damage. I'm fine with that. So, but I think Garcia has more life in him. I think, you know, I was going through Hamilton's game log, and there's just a lot of empty at-bats around some kind of cool things. And it's easy when it's that kind of, when he's making the kind of fan-pleasing impact that he makes with individual at-bats, it makes it easy to overlook the amount he's not doing over the course of three or four games. And so that's why I don't really want to see too much playing time slide his way, because I think that could, you know, throw it out of balance, and all of a sudden, you know, he's kind of racking up a debt in terms of bad plate appearances overwhelming the good ones. And I think Garcia is more likely to have good ones, but as long as they're, you know, in a timeshare, basically, I really don't care if it's 50-50 or 60-40 in one direction. I think just keeping them in the same spot on the diamond is the most important thing.
When I watch Lurie Garcia, I'm just, I don't know if he's going to get hot, right? Like, his numbers are still poor, and it's like, he can be a good player. We've seen him be a good player for the White Sox and be somebody that, you know, should be getting the playing time that he's getting. You put it a good way, to the extent that I care. But we're dealing with this until Luis Robert could prove that he can run. I know he's off crutches right now, as he posted on his Instagram. So that's great as far as in his recovery. And we may be seeing Adam Engel soon, so this could make the entire conversation moot. And Adam Engel would be your starting center fielder instead of Lurie Garcia or Billy Hamilton. But if it's a coin flip and, you know, you're deciding who's going to start on that day between Garcia and Hamilton in center field, I think I side with Hamilton because he's a better center fielder than Garcia.
Yeah, I think I maybe side with him just because I enjoy the smiles.
Although
Garcia's got a great one, too. They both have very winning smiles. So good job on their dental work.
More smiles, the better. Well, again, White Sox fans have a good reason to smile after this week. The White Sox go 6-1, and they make their way to Cleveland for Memorial Day. So they'll play four games in 3 days before they turn around and head back home for another 7-game homestand against Detroit and Toronto. Jim and I will preview that series in Cleveland coming up later in the show, but we're going to be taking a quick break on the Sox Machine podcast with a word from our sponsors. And after our sponsors, coming up next, Jim has your minor league report. If you love listening to us here on the Sox Machine...
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this. But Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Podcast. What's stopping you from grabbing a mic and starting your own show? And there's no better place to host than Blue Wire Hustle. Hustle was created to give everyone the opportunity to take your podcast to the next level. Or if you want to host a podcast and just don't know where to start, Hustle is the perfect place for you. As part of the program, you'll receive personal cover art, Q&As with Blue Wire's top podcasters, access to the community Discord, and an e-learning course full of tips and tricks. And on top of that, we'll help you get your show pushed out to Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, and all other listening platforms. And the best part is, you can get all of this for only $15 a month, the same rate as any other hosting site would charge you just for the initial setup. So if you're ready to do more than just listening to us talk about the White Sox, then make your voice heard in Hustle. Acceptance into the program is limited, so get your application in today. To apply, go to bwhustle.com/join, and you can check out the description box in this episode to find out more. But that's bwhustle.com/join.
The economy is made up of real people doing real stuff, and it affects everything. Which you obviously know, since you're a real person doing real stuff. Marketplace is here to help you get smart about everything beyond the what of the day's business and economic news. We dig into the how and the why with the real people driving our economy. From big tech and interest rates to small businesses and what's happening at the Fed, Marketplace breaks it all down so you don't have to. Listen to Marketplace wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, minor league report time. We'll start in Charlotte, where Jimmy Lambert received a call to start one of today's doubleheader games against Cleveland. Since Michael Kopech is still on the bereavement list and has a hamstring issue of some undetermined severity, Lambert earned the gig partially due to timing and partially due to his numbers, which took a turn for the better after pitching somewhere besides Truist Field in Charlotte. He threw 3 innings apiece over his last 2 starts in Durham and Norfolk, and he struck out 11 over those 6 innings against 4 hits and 3 walks, allowing just a solo homer of damage each time. Jonathan Stever pitched Sunday and struggled, and Reynaldo Lopez looked like himself, for better or for worse. The starting pitcher who is doing the heaviest lifting is KBO veteran Mike Wright, but he's not on the 40-man roster. Jace Fry might beat everybody to Chicago. He's thrown a couple of scoreless hitless rehab appearances, with 1 walk and 4 strikeouts over 2 innings. Adam Engel's doing just as well in his own comeback, going 6-for-16 with a homer, double, and a walk against just 3 strikeouts. The rest of the offense followed suit with strong work at the plate, even if it was lighter in power. Gavin Sheets and Brian Goodwin both went 7-for-16 with 6 singles apiece. Jake Berger went 6-for-17 with a double and a reasonable strikeout rate. Blake Rutherford saw the most action of anybody and batted .280 with 3 doubles. In Birmingham, Mike Rodolfo salvaged what could have been a relapse with a big Sunday, going 3-for-4 with a double and 2 walks in the Barons' 17-4 victory over the Rocket City Trash Pandas. Even with the big finale, he went 4-for-22 over the past week, with 12 strikeouts over 26 plate appearances. Carlos Perez, Tyquan Forbes, and Romy Gonzalez all struggled, with Gonzalez going 1-for-20 with 11 strikeouts after a sizzling start to his season. But Birmingham is 16-8 because the pitching remains strong, especially after the addition of Jason Billis, who threw 7 innings of 2-run ball over his first appearances at AA this past week. After issuing 61 walks in A-ball in 2019, the 2018 13th rounder has walked just 2 batters against 33 strikeouts over 21 and two-thirds innings. Cade McClure also had a bounce-back week with 9 strikeouts over 5, and Connor Pilkington and Blake Battenfield have been good for a solid 5 every time out. The Winston-Salem Dash continue to hover at .500 despite similarly lackluster offense. The Dash lineup mostly rides the bat of Luis Curbelo, for better or for worse. He went just 5-for-21 with 10 strikeouts over the last 6 games, but 3 of those hits went for extra bases. Also, 2020 undrafted free agent signing Duke Ellis went 5-for-15 with 3 walks and 2 stolen bases from the Dash's center field spot. The pitching staff lost Billis, but that just gives Davis Martin more room to breathe. Martin is up to 31 strikeouts against 4 walks over 21 innings, including 10 strikeouts over 5 his last time out against Hickory. He was selected a round after Billis in the 2018 draft, and you might be following him to Birmingham in short order, although a vacancy might be difficult to come by right now. And then there's Kannapolis. The Cannonballers lost all 6 games to the Carolina Mudcats in Zebulon, North Carolina, to drop to 2-22 on the season, and even Jose Rodriguez is starting to cool down, going 4-for-22 over the last week. At least he struck out only 4 times compared to somebody like DJ Gladney, who went 3-for-20 with 11 Ks. There are a couple items of silver lining. Brian Ramos has started to get it going, batting .381 with 2 homers, a double, and 3 walks over the 6-game series, which is a lot of production around 8 strikeouts. Prep picks Lency Delgado and Cabrera Weaver also homered twice. The pitching's been the biggest issue, including rough starts for Yoelvin Sylvan and Drew Dahlquist, who combined to allow 11 runs over 3 2/3 innings. Matthew Thompson was also roughed up on Monday, but he was able to close out his week by striking out 6 over 3 shutout innings, so maybe this upcoming week will be better for everybody. At least Jared Kelly got to sit this one out, as the White Sox are managing his workload. That's it for the minor league report. Visit Sox Machine on Tuesday for Farm Fortnite, a bi-weekly summary of the White Sox farm system that covers all prospects of note, exclusive to those who support Sox Machine on Patreon. If you do not yet subscribe, you can do so at patreon.com/SoxMachine.
The Chicago White Sox now make their way to Cleveland, Ohio, as they'll play 4 games in 3 days, including a doubleheader on Memorial Day, Monday, and then they'll have a Tuesday night game, and then getaway day is Wednesday afternoon. So if you enjoy afternoon baseball, you are going to get more of it from the White Sox in this series. The Cleveland Indians are currently 28-23. They are second place in the American League Central, behind the Chicago White Sox, 3.5 games, as the White Sox did make it 1 game as far as add to their lead over against Cleveland over the last 10 games. The Cleveland Indians are just 5-5 in their last 10 games as they split a doubleheader against the Toronto Blue Jays on Sunday. The Cleveland Indians have a -7 run differential, so they are currently overachieving right now with their win-loss record. The season series between the White Sox and Indians is 4-4. So after this series, Cleveland and the White Sox will only have 7 more games against each other in 2021. Your pitching problems for this series for Monday. Again, this is going to be a doubleheader. The first game is going to start at 2:10 p.m. Central Time. Tristan McKenzie will be starting that game for Cleveland. Their starter for Game 2 is still to be determined. For the White Sox, they haven't sorted out who's starting which games yet, but we do believe that Carlos Rodon will start one of the two games. The other starter is going to be Jimmy Lampert, which is really interesting. And then for the White Sox on Tuesday night at 5:10 p.m. Central Time, it is Dylan Cease on the mound for the White Sox. And on getaway day, Wednesday, 12:10, it is Lance Lynn on short rest. And for Monday's doubleheader, I know White Sox fans that are not the biggest fans of the 7-inning doubleheader. The White Sox are 7-1 in 2021 in 7-inning doubleheader games. They were 0-2 in 2020. All right, Jim, a lot of uncertainty when it comes to the pitching probables for this series, and it is a key series because from a Cleveland perspective, this is an opportunity. If Cleveland can win 3 out of 4 against the White Sox, or if they could sweep the White Sox at home, they can get themselves back in first place in the American League Central. If they do not perform well against the White Sox, if they don't get a split, or if they lose 3 out of 4, or they lose all 4 games, then all of a sudden the White Sox have a big cushion within the division. So this is a pretty big series for Cleveland if they are still trying to make the American League Central interesting as the calendar flips from May to June. But with so much uncertainty when it comes to the pitching probables for this series, what are you focusing right now between this series with the White Sox and Indians?
Well, I'm hoping that uncertainty, especially on Cleveland's side when it comes to scheduling pitchers, is a product of just their instability, especially when it comes to control. They've walked, they're third in baseball with walks in the month of May. They've walked 113 batters over 227 innings, which is very uncharacteristic when you think of a staff that is headed by Shane Bieber and Zach Plesac. The White Sox have walked 78 batters. So you're talking about like almost a 40 walk difference in May alone between the two pitching staffs. And probably going into the season, if you were wondering, like, if you put that number, if you put the walks and innings against each other and said Team A and Team B and try to guess the team, you'd flip them. You would think the White Sox would be the ones with control problems with Rodon and Cease and the bullpen struggling the way it is. But they've had a lot of walks. Even Shane Bieber has been walking more guys than normal. And Class A has been just battling control issues at the closer role. Brian Shaw's been walking more guys, so there should be opportunities to generate traffic. It's just more of that, the irritating or aggravating part of watching the White Sox sometimes in this season and the last couple seasons is their weakness against right-handed pitching and not being able to capitalize on those rallies. But it seems like there should be lots of traffic to at least generate those runners and scoring position opportunities.
How do you feel about Lance Lynn pitching on short rest this early in the season?
With Michael Kopech being uncertain, that's something I'm wondering about. He kind of hobbled off the field awkwardly, and then he went on the bereavement list. So we don't really know what his severity is and what that hamstring looks like. And also there's not really a whole lot of compelling arms in the bullpen to bring up either to rotate for like a Johnny Holstaff game. So if you already have one doubleheader involved and you're calling Jimmy Lampert, who's had a couple of good starts in a row, but for 3 innings at a time. So he's maybe not the most proven bet to, try to go 5. Then the options are pretty much limited. So it might be worth a look just to, maybe a postseason preview to understand like how guys do on short rest. And I think, La Russa did well to limit Lynn's outing the start before. Like I saw people wondering why is he being pulled after 5? Why is Bummer in? Why is Bummer, loading the bases, nobody out when Lynn could be pitching? And that was when I looked at the calendar and realized, like, oh yeah, they started Keuchel and Lynn the same day, because they had two doubleheaders over the course of 3 days. Like, the options are limited, especially if Kopech is not right. So as long as we don't exactly know what's up with him, like, if he were able to come off the bereavement list, I would be happy starting him for like 3 or 4 innings, seeing what happens. But if he's not an option, I don't know where else to go. So you may as well use a guy like Lynn and then hopefully make it up to him with rest, you know, following an off day.
Yeah, that's the way it does look, because if he does make this start on Wednesday, June 2nd, the White Sox have an off day on Monday, June 7th. So he'll get about 6 days of rest before making his next start. Which again, you're making it up to him as far as trying to get into rhythm, but the way that he's been throwing, and he's kind of got that bulldog mentality, Jim, that I don't think Lance Lynn really cares. I wouldn't be surprised if he threw 100 pitches in this start. I would feel uncomfortable, just be like, oh, I don't want him to go back on the injured list. He's throwing too well. But it'd be interesting to see on how long he does last. And I think the goal is obviously 5 innings again, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I imagine he would expect 6, because I imagine he expects to go 7, so he'll have to ratchet it down one. But, you know, it reminds me of the whole bulldog thing of Jake Peavy, and just how, you know, Peavy got hurt and Peavy got overused, but that wasn't his fault. That was the fault of, you know, Ozzie Guillen and Don Cooper having their little rift and not communicating, and Peavy ultimately winning every single argument. It's, you know, incumbent on Tony La Russa and Ethan Katz to keep his workload in check. And so I think they did a decent job the start before, just to make sure that he wasn't going to be coming into a short rest start with 110 pitches on his arm from the previous time around. But I think it's, you know, just try not to ask too much from him. You know, if he's got 5 innings and 90 pitches, probably a good time to pull the hook, unless, you know, the labor was early on. He's been coasting ever since. And I think it's probably also, you know, important for the defense to play well behind him, because, you know, it seems like he's been the guy to get the worst support, you know, whether it's errors in the field or Yasmani Grandal committing a catcher interference. Just seems like there's always something adding pitches to his pitch count. And so I'm hoping that this time around, given that, you know, the White Sox are asking a little bit more from him, that the defense can step up and remove some of the load.
And he's still second in the American League in ERA, despite all of this.
Well, I think he's got a few unearned runs on his tab, so it does show up there. But yeah, he's been done a good job pitching through it. Just more, it seems to cost him, you know, the ability to face a few more batters at the end of a start.
Well, hopefully the White Sox play well defensively behind Lance Lynn. They play well for the entire series. One thing I'm going to be looking for is the offense. I would like to see the offense generate a little bit more run support, especially for their pitchers. It is Cleveland, though. They still do pitch well, even though they put a lot of men on base, as you were mentioning earlier, Jim, as far as the walks. There'll be a lot of traffic, and I do think that the White Sox will generate a lot of opportunities with runners in scoring position. I would just like them to be a little bit more effective than they have been. Because if there's one thing to nitpick about the White Sox in this 6-1 week against St. Louis and Baltimore, is that they did squander some really golden opportunities with runners in scoring position and not taking advantage of those opportunities. And but this seems to be a league-wide problem right now, and the White Sox are one of the better performing teams with runners in scoring position, but I like them to be a little bit more effective in this series against Cleveland, because if the White Sox can play well offensively in these 4 games, and by playing well, I mean like being able to generate 5 runs in each of these games, you're going to give yourself a shot to really win this series easily, like 3 out of 4, or even sweep Cleveland. And now we would be talking about a 7-game lead for the Chicago White Sox in the month of June.
This is a, you know, I'm thinking of that Yermín Mercedes at bat where, you know, he hit a screamer grounder, like a one hopper. Freddy Galvis makes the pick and ends up getting the inning, when really, you know, if maybe most of the shortstops, or at least, you know, maybe half the shortstops aren't as lucky with the ball finding their glove the way it did. And, you know, Mercedes gets a 2-run single out of it, and that game looks a whole lot better. So they had some decent swings, and they built some rallies. it wasn't like the characteristic struggles of like previous seasons to where like Jose Abreu expanded the zone and got ugly. Like you're just trying to do too much. It does seem like between Abreu and Moncada, Mercedes a little bit, and then Grandal has kind of picked it up a little bit too to at least generate traffic. And Andrew Vaughn stepping up as well. That they have enough guys, I think, that they trust with runners on, even if the results aren't there yet. I'm not seeing like the crazy at-bats, the crazy swings, the what are you doing swings as much. So I'm more or less encouraged, especially as you mentioned, that runners in scoring position and performances with runners on third across the league is really like it's never been tougher to hit with a runner on third than it is now. And that's just something you have to keep in mind. The one guy I'm, you know, while looking at the Indians numbers right. in May, and over the last week, like Eddie Rosario is finally starting to pick it up. And he's a guy I'm watching just because I'm kind of keeping tabs loosely on everybody who might have been a decent option for right field with the White Sox. And, you know, really, you know, Adam Eaton, Jock Peterson, you know, Rosario is another one. They all kind of signed for a similar amount. And Eaton was the one that I was least impressed by. And so far, Peterson's been able to pass him. Rosario's been more or less about the same as Eaton. But I'm kind of waiting for Rosario to get on one of those runs that he had with the Twins, where he'd get up to 30 homers and 100 RBIs. And last week, at least, it seemed like he was actually picking up towards that. So if the White Sox can keep him in check and keep me from like updating my ledger to wonder why the White Sox rushed into signing Eaton, that would be appreciated.
Yeah, and hopefully no situations late in games where Jose Ramirez can quickly change or sway on how the outcome goes. Because that guy, the last couple of seasons, just got to give him respect. He's been phenomenal in these high leverage situations for Cleveland against the White Sox. So hopefully the White Sox are not in that situation at all this series against Jose Ramirez, because he seems to love facing the White Sox as of late. But we will recap this series between the White Sox and the Indians later this week on Wednesday, June 2nd at night during Sox Machine Live, which you could watch on our YouTube page at youtube.com/SoxMachine or on SoxMachine.com. And we'll also preview the upcoming four-game series against the Detroit Tigers. But coming up next on this podcast, you guys had a lot of questions for us in PO Sox, so let's answer them next.
You've stuffed our mailbox all week with questions from your tweets and Facebook posts. Now to cure your curiosity on the White Sox, here is P.O. Sox.
Thanks, Rob. And yes, this is our favorite part of the show, where you, our fans and listeners, get to ask the questions. It's P.O. Sox, where our Patreon supporters, which we have over 530 now, so thank you guys so much for your support, which you can sign up at patreon.com/SoxMachine. Jim, they have stuffed the P.O. Sox mailbag once again. And our Patreon supporters, you definitely want to stick around, because we couldn't answer all of the questions in the normal podcast. But if you are a Patreon supporter getting the Patreon podcast feed, we've got a lot of bonus P.O. Sox questions for you in this episode. So sit back, relax, and hunker down. We got a lot of questions to go through here, Jim. So let's start with the first one, and it comes from Mohammed. And Mohammed is asking, Jim, why do you have no taste in regards to the White Sox City Connect uniforms?
Coming in hot. I think either, you know, I did not present, you know, I guess my ultimate view, or at least my view on the City Connect uniforms independently of the mission. And my view on the uniforms as just a standalone uniform, if they just presented it without any kind of tie-in, without any kind of other examples to go off of like the other teams had, I would think it's fine. Like, I like the dark fabric with the white pinstripes. I like the, you know, I more or less like the font. I just, the only thing I don't like about it is Southside being one word in that font with no capitalized S on the side. Just kind of, it all kind of mushes together. And it kind of looks like a font, or it kind of looks like a word that was created by somebody who lives outside of Chicago. Like, yeah, you know, I would think, you know, if it's a Chicago uniform, Southside should be two words. If it's City Connect, if you're connecting with the city, you know, it should be two words. And to turn it into one word, with this makes it seem like somebody else made the mistake from out of town, and now everybody has to pretend it's something they're planning on doing. So that's what I don't like about it. The hat, I think I can take, like, it, I don't think the hat's good. Just kind of boring, but the uniform is great. The thing I don't like about the City Connect uniform is that, you know, they, when it comes to the White Sox uniforms, like, I wouldn't mind seeing a little bit more color. Like, it seems like you're seeing the players introduce red into their uniforms, the batting gloves and sleeves and socks. Like, it seems like they enjoy, like, the red accents on their, you know, non-uniform equipment, accessories. And so, you know, it'd be cool, I think, to, you know, kind of take a nod from that, or the stars, or what have you, to just, you know, add a little bit of color. But, you know, it seems like, it reminded me of, you ever watch, like, a cooking or baking competition, like Great British Bake Off? And, you know, the task is you have to bake a challah, and somebody bakes a brioche.
Hmm.
And it's because, well, it's like, well, they're close enough. And I, you know, I'm more comfortable with French cuisine. I think it's better. So I'm going to try to make a really good brioche and pass it off as challah, and then hope they don't catch me, or hope it's good enough to where they don't care. And that's what this kind of reminded me of. Just like, you know, you're supposed to take inspiration from the city, and they took inspiration from themselves. And that was just a little bit weird. Like a little bit, you felt like they missed the point. And that's kind of, you know, when I saw what it was supposed to be, and like the Boston Marathon uniforms that the Red Sox wore, I didn't quite understand. Like, I didn't think they were necessarily good looking, but I also thought, like, oh, that's kind of neat. I get what they're going for. I didn't realize the Boston Marathon wore those colors, but I learned something from having seen their uniforms. With the White Sox and with their Southside uniforms, like, it just feels like, I think Janice on Twitter put it like, they took their home uniform and the road grays and put them in a blender, and or their black uniforms and the road grays, and then that's what came out. And that's kind of how it looks, except it was Southside instead of Chicago. So that's just why I felt like it was a little underwhelming in terms of, it seemed like the whole idea of the City Connect uniform was to just take a kind of a audacious, bold swing at a design concept based on something that was related to the city, like the greater city, and the White Sox kept it insular.
Well, John Greenberg of The Athletic, who's been on this show, so I could say that he's a friend of the podcast, he was able to talk to Brooks Boyer about the process. And that's a really good article. I highly recommend going to The Athletic and going through it, because John finds out what the process was and how they got these City Connect uniforms. It was a 2-year process working with Nike. And you mentioned somebody out of town came up with this. Yeah, that out of towner was Nike out in Oregon, in Beaverton, coming up with it. As someone that has purchased one of the jerseys, I have to tell you, Jim, from a comfort aspect, it is one of the most comfortable baseball jerseys I have ever donned. It is comfy, like almost silk-like. And I'm wondering how that will play out on the field, because sometimes baseball jerseys kind of have a heavy feel.
It's like the Seinfeld plot.
What do you mean?
How do they wash? There's a Seinfeld episode where George wanted them in cotton uniforms instead of, I think it was a poly blend, because they're more comfortable and softer and lighter, but then they shrink in the wash.
Oh, well.
And so, you know, it ended up being successful for like one series or one game, and then next time out, they were binding.
it's a very comfy jersey. And being at Sports Depot, I know you touched on this as well, that, okay, well, the White Sox made a uniform that will sell really well. We went into the store. We stood in line because Kim had a work meeting that she had to get to. So we had to be there when the doors opened so we could get back home in time for her to have that meeting. She really loved the look, and she really wanted Tim Anderson's jersey. So we get to the Sports Depot. It's 11:50, and there's already a line. And we get through the door, and she was smart. She went straight to the Tim Anderson rack. She got her size. We walked away from that area. I saw the Eloy Jimenez rack, and nobody was going to that one. And I thought, hey, he can't play in these. This could be a collector's item one day. So that's why I picked Eloy's uniform for the City Connect. Tim Anderson's uniform in the 30 minutes we were in that store had to be restocked twice. So that was by far the most popular jersey. And what makes sense as far as connecting the dots that the White Sox started this process 2 years ago, there are no Jose Abreu jerseys in the Sports Depot. The reigning MVP doesn't have a City Connect uniform that I could buy. Like, I was disappointed, but then I remembered 2 years ago, Jim, Jose Abreu was going to be a free agent after the season. We didn't know for sure if Abreu was going to be coming back. Of course, we remember that Abreu publicly was put Rick Hahn in a tough position because Jerry Reinsdorf really wanted Abreu to come back, and Abreu really wanted to come back as well. But it, you know, in that article in The Athletic, Brooks Boyer did say that more uniforms are coming, especially during this week and before the White Sox wear them next Saturday against Detroit, and they should have more players available as well. But the only players that they had, only two of them were actually playing games, because you had Tim Anderson, you had Yoan Moncada, and then you had Luis Robert and Eloy Jimenez. So I like him. I get your perspective as far as adding an accent color, but there's been some good commentary as well that this is an opportunity for the White Sox for the first time embracing the hip hop culture side, because there has been a lot of critiques and commentary about how the White Sox as an organization have not embraced that side as far as the culture, despite being very popular with hip hop artists, especially throughout the 90s and even today, and, you know, making Chance the Rapper mad and him ditching the Sox cap to make his own cap. There's a lot of people that are mentioning and that really like the uniform, that this is, you know, the White Sox are embracing that part of the South Side more than they ever have.
I get it. You know, and it's I really like the dark and white, because it reminds me of the Chicago American Giants jerseys.
Oh, okay.
The Negro Leagues jerseys. Yeah. And that's, I thought that was the inspiration for that, you know, the color pattern. And Nike didn't mention it. And I was like, oh, well, I'll pretend it's inspired by the Chicago American Giants. But I really like that look. I like that look when they wear it in the double duty game that they play at the, they play for the prep players, the City prep players at Guaranteed Rate Field. Like, those uniforms always look great. So I like that kind of inspiration. It's just really, I think, just the South Side, all one word, as somebody who, you know, sees it, you know, kind of mangled by people not from here, or I should say from there, because I'm in Nashville right now, but not, you know, outside the White Sox orbit and outside Chicagoland, to see it all one word, and then just, it feels like giving in to people who didn't know how to spell it.
Got it. I'm not crazy about the cap. I will say that.
Yeah.
I'm not crazy about the cap. I think you can wear the regular cap with the Southside uniforms and you will be good.
It's like the Chicago Tribune C. And
The
Tribune, you know, it's the Gothic C. I mean, like, you know, maybe with that font, there's only, you know, so many ways you can do it, but just like, Tribune has never really, you know, done great things for the Sox.
No.
I think it's often overblown, but it's just like, they didn't staff a beat writer on the Sox beat for 2 or 3 years.
Right.
So, yeah, just, it's like, that C is not what I associate with the White Sox. So, yeah, the hat, I think, is a miss. Uniform is fine. It's just, I was hoping for, I think, color. But, you know, like you mentioned, I think if it replaced the 83s, or it replaced the black jerseys, and then maybe they thought of an alternate uniform that was different from the 83s, I think that'd be another way to go.
Yeah, the 83s are overdone. I know people love them, and they want them to stay around forever. But Rob Hart, our good friend Rob Hart, mentioned that the 83s have had a longer run in the present than they did in the mid-80s.
Yeah. The one thing I will say is, like, you know, just not being in Chicago and being places that don't have any connection to Chicago, I see the Batterman repurposed a lot for amateur teams, for like travel ball, for, you know, lower levels. It's really popular. So I can see why the White Sox might not want to abandon it, given how often it gets repurposed. But when they introduced that, you know, when they brought that uniform back, it just also, a lot of bad baseball accompanied that. So I think that's why I'm more or less content to close the door on that, maybe try other uniform pairings. But yeah, the uniform's fine. I just was hoping that, you know, I didn't mind garish or audacious like the way the Boston uniform was, because at least once I had explained to me, or once I read the explanation, like I got what they were going for and thought, well, that's different. And I don't mind different. Like, I guess I don't, I'm not repulsed by ideas of, you know, concepts that don't work, because it, like, at least it's new intellectual property, I guess.
The conversations in the city, especially after this weekend and the homestand, everybody has an opinion on the White Sox City Connect uniforms, and it varies from fine to I absolutely love it. I haven't met anyone that hates it. The next conversation is, all right, what are the Cubs going to do? Because the White Sox went for a look to represent the South Side. That was the angle that they were aiming for. And I think everyone assumes the Chicago Cubs are going to do something with the Chicago flag and then try to say that they are representing the entire city of Chicago, which is going to piss off everybody on the South Side.
Yeah, but I think that's, you know, when you kind of are insular like that and look towards yourselves for inspiration and limit, like, geographically where you're coming from, what you're pointing to, you do open that opportunity for somebody to say, okay, we're Chicago then.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a whole other podcast. That is a loaded topic in the city of Chicago when it comes to the North Side and the South Side, and having lived both sides. I've got thoughts about that, but Mohammed, I hope we answered your question about the City Connect uniforms, and thank you so much for your question. Our next question comes from Michael, and Michael wrote to us a couple weeks ago when discussing Lucas Giolito. The spin rate on his changeup was brought up. Have there been any changes to that, and is that part of the reason for his return to greatness?
Well, I think for me, looking at his changeup, I was looking more at the velocity gap between his changeup and his fastball. And the fastball wasn't as crisp and powerful as it had been. And the changeup wasn't, wasn't proportionally softer. It was, it had lost some velocity as well, but you know, the gap had closed from usually 12 to 13 to like 10 to 11. And even though that's a sizable gap for most pitchers when it comes to changeup disparities, it's, for the way Giolito uses it, for the kind of fluttering, floating pitch that he uses and you know, pairs with his fastball and throws high in the zone, just the way hitters were reacting to it, the way hitters you know, squared it up, made a louder contact on it than usual, put it into play more than usual, suggested that it wasn't enough, that it just didn't have that kind of soft action to it relative to his fastball. And so I think, you know, watching him come back the last two or three starts, it seems like he's it's a couple things. I think the arm slot situation is closer to what it was at his peak. You can look at his release points for all three pitches, and like the slider was way off for like a few starts, so that was tipped away, so you can eliminate that pitch from the get-go. And there was also a bit of difference in a bit of a lower release point for his fastball and his changeup, and so it had more fade on it and just more of a circle change action when he throws it straight change and doesn't really want that much of a dip and fade to it. So it seems like by resolving that and by making the slider more of a threat as well, it's allowed his changeup to be more of the monster it was before. Just, you know, having that, it's not really a rise with the changeup, but it doesn't sink as much as other changeups do, and it doesn't fade. It doesn't tail the way other changeups do. It just kind of floats there and doesn't come down. And the way hitters swing at it, you know, it seems like it doesn't come down. And so, you know, with the changeup, you know, it's a weird pitch in that when you look at the underlying stats, you can tell some, you know, there are some characteristics based on, you know, how many inches of run, how many inches of sink, spin rate, and so forth, but it doesn't pop off the page. I think it's a case where, almost like we talked about with Jose Abreu, and you mentioned the fastball stats and his ability to turn around velocity, and I just looked at his RBI column, and I kind of look at Giolito the same way in that, like, when you're watching him and you're just watching the swings will tell you whether his changeup's any good. And you're starting with the start in Boston and then a few starts afterwards. It just wasn't the same pitch. And now you're watching him face the Twins and the Cardinals and the Orioles, and you're seeing those weird swings underneath it that no other pitcher gets with his high changeup, except for maybe like Devin Williams with that airbender pitch. That shows his changeup is back. And I think it's just the fastball being back at 94 to 96 versus 92 to 93 that helps set it up. And it's just the context of his other pitches makes that changeup so much better.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for your question. Our next question comes from Mark Zambor. And Mark wrote to us, Jim, most recently with Yermin Mercedes responding with a home run Thursday night, Josh's podcast rants this season have inspired immediate results from Dylan Cease, Jose Abreu, Nick Madrigal, Jake Lamb, and Lucas Giolito. Can we get an Aaron Bummer rant?
Can we?
No, not Aaron Bummer. You know, he started off well in the first part of the month. From May 1st through May 14th, he only allowed one hit. And what is it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, 5 appearances. He only allowed one hit, no walks. He was really good against Cleveland, Kansas City, and Minnesota as far as those appearances. Yeah, he's been struggling as of late. And I can't pinpoint why he's been struggling. He's allowed 2 home runs, which he didn't allow a home run before allowing the home run to Miguel Sano in that loss in Minnesota. He hadn't allowed a home run since 2019, which is a pretty long stretch for any pitcher. So I don't have anything as far as with Aaron Bummer, as far as rants. And yes, the reverse jinx magic appears to be real. I didn't ask for this power, folks. I just have it. The way that it works, though, is I got to point out something that a player is not doing particularly well, harp on that, and then watch them exceed doing that thing that I just harped on them that they weren't doing well.
Wait for aggression to take its course. It's like the opposite of the SI cover jinx. Like the SI catches people at the top of their game, you catch people at the bottom of their game.
I do, except I still don't think Abreu is doing well against the fastball. And I think teams are... I think that's a swing plane problem, but that's for a good blog post, because I'm noticing his swing plane, the way that pitchers are just attacking Jose Abreu, for example. They're aiming high with that fastball, and it's pretty clear that they are avoiding the barrel as much as possible against Jose Abreu. I totally understand why. I don't understand why John Means threw a changeup to Jose Abreu. We mentioned those things as well with my rants. They are doing X really well. They are doing Y really poorly. They need to focus on trying to improve Y. I don't have one right now. And I feel bad, Mark. I feel bad that I don't have a built-in rant right now. But maybe we should have a request box, a reverse jinx request box. And then I can do some digging. I just don't have anything for Aaron Bummer right now.
Yeah, I don't have anything. Yeah, I think with Bummer, you know, given that his pitches are lively and that, you know, his velocity is there, like it's nothing wrong with the pitches. I think to me, just watching him and maybe like doing a little armchair diagnosis, it's more like, you know, to me, like the Sano homer kind of shocked him a little bit. And since then, like he's been really trying to stay out of the middle of the zone and just trying to like make every pitch a put-away pitch, like trying to use a slider for like strikeout on, you know, on a 1-1 count, or using a sinker and trying to get like swings over the top of it versus just ground balls in play, which I think is, you know, he developed the ability to strike out guys, but I don't see him as like a strikeout pitcher. I see somebody who gets a lot of ground balls and just his stuff is so, you know, he gets such weird contact on his first few pitches of an at bat when they try to swing that he gets into 2 strike counts and can put him away at the slider. Like it seems like almost the strikeouts are incidental to just how much action his pitches have when he's just trying to get ground balls. So when I watch him pitch and I watch him like fall behind 3-1 and throwing all these sliders like back foot, like missing glove side and almost hitting right-handed hitters, to me, it seems like, you know, maybe the snow homer by a right-handed hitter made him like think like, oh, I got way too careless trying to get ground balls or trying to get soft contact. And now I need to focus and bear down and get those swings and misses. And I don't think that's him. I think he's just somebody who has to throw the ball, you know, kind of the, I most associate it with Edwin Jackson, just, you know, throw it in the middle of the plate and your action on the pitches will, you know, do the work for you. And I think Bummer has, you know, more command than that suggests, but I think when he gets in these little ruts that he gets in, it seems like he'd be well off doing that, especially like a lineup like Baltimore's or a, you know, when you don't have like a home run threat at the plate, like, you know, just make them do the work. Like that's with Cody Hoyer. You know, like he got out of the jam that Bummer created. And, you know, Hoyer's had problems with that approach, like throwing his sinker in the zone. Like his sinker is not quite Aaron Bummer's sinker. So he just can't throw strikes with it and get ground balls magically. Like they're turning into line drives right now. But at least he threw a line drive and it went to Billy Hamilton in center and they didn't score a run on it. So that's kind of how I think Bummer has to operate, especially against lesser opponents when nobody's on base. Just throw the pitch, like just throw a strike and make lesser hitters prove that they can get it in the air, because a lot of times they can't.
So, Mark, I'm sorry that I don't have a rant right now, but you know what? We'll take requests. So for our Patreon supporters, maybe we'll just set up a Josh Reverse Jinx rant request box and people can submit players and I could do some dives and, you know, I'll build up a rant and then we'll watch that player make me look stupid the next day. So let's go ahead and take those collections. So back to the Jose Abreu fastball thing. I just pulled up his Baseball Savant numbers. Mm-hmm. So against righties, the four-seamer numbers have bounced back to normal. He's hitting 289 with slugging 500 against the four-seamer against righties. And he's doing awesome. And I've been mentioning that in the commentary as well for Abreu with his struggles at the beginning of the year against fastballs. Abreu's doing great against sliders this year. Righty's throwing sliders to Abreu. He's hitting 368 and he's slugging 658 this season. And he's still seeing sliders just as much as he has in past seasons. What is really dropping off though is sinker and curveball numbers. If you're a righty and you got a sinker, you're kind of owning Jose Abreu right now. Abreu's only hitting 172 and slugging 207 against sinkers. That's a pretty big drop-off from last year, in which Abreu hit 463 and slugged 683 against sinkers. And the curveball against righties, he's only hitting 143 and slugging 214. So I see this, and if Cleveland has any pitchers that throw a sinker-curveball combo, guess what? That's what you're throwing to a Jose Abreu. You're not throwing four-seam slider combos. He will kill you right now if you do that. You got to go sinker curveball. So there you go, Mark. That's my reverse jinx. I want to see if Abreu can hit any of these sinker curveball combos that Cleveland will throw against him in this series and watch him have two home runs against the sinker.
Yeah, it's a good thing that the two-seamer is kind of out of vogue.
It is.
So
it is, and it makes you wonder, well, maybe it shouldn't be.
When you talking about velocity, like that's something I'm watching with Mercedes is just.
Yeah, and I think you got a good point there.
It's I just looked it up on pitches hotter than or 94 miles per hour and faster. He only has two batted balls over 100 miles per hour. And then you can include 199 and then everything else has an exit velocity under 95.
Wow, he's not getting hard contact against velocity 94 miles per hour or more.
Yeah, like anything that qualifies as above average.
And the reason why that's odd for those that are listening and being like, okay, what's the big deal about that? When you're getting that type of velocity, it's doing a lot of work for you. You just have to make good enough contact to take advantage of that type of velocity. And it seems like based on those numbers, Jim, he's just having a tough time barreling up that type of velocity.
Yeah, he's not scoring it up.
Is the bat slow?
Could be.
Open discussion. Sox Machine listeners, let's dig
into
this.
When you hit the homer, Shane Harmon like tweeted us saying, did we reverse jinx him? And I was like, I'm not sure, no. Because that was a 90 mile per hour fastball.
Yeah.
Low and inside from a lefty. Just like that's some righty's changeups.
So, right. We talked about that. If you're going to throw him inside or middle in the first two strikes, he's going to hurt you because he's looking to pull. It's what can he do on the outside corner pitches in the first two strikes? And can he pull pitches with two strikes? That's been the focus point with Mercedes. So yeah, and I'm also with you. The home run did not reverse the jinx.
And also the exit velocity is the top three, 99, 103, 104 are all grounders.
Yeah, that type of data would make one go and start watching some film on Baseball Savant and wonder if he's just not getting the barrel through the zone quick enough. If the bat is slower than we thought.
Yeah.
Ooh. And I have that big sigh because if we can notice this, opposing teams most definitely notice this.
Well, I think they have noticed it.
Okay.
Because I'm seeing more fastballs. And just not seeing the damage, like, oh, that's a two, you know, he's got the, you know, he's getting two strikes on fastballs and then getting fastballs after two strikes. Like, they're kind of going at him. And he's, you know, he's been doing okay, or at least not slumping as hard as other guys with that problem do, because he does have that two strike approach and does work enough pitches away and does follow enough pitches, like with that crouch that he does, to draw walks that maybe others couldn't do, or you know, extended bats to get a bloop single here and there. But when it comes like DH type velocity and impact, it seems like they can neutralize that.
Well, that's going to be our homework assignment, folks. Open discussion item. Let's all together as a community start looking into this and wonder if your Mercedes can wake up a little bit here, or if the White Sox, to come full circle, Jim, may need to give Jake Lamb some DH playing time while Mercedes gets a little bit more time off. But Mark, there you go, man. I know there's a long-winded way of going about it, but again, we'll open up that reverse jinx suggestion box. We'll start taking your suggestions for Josh's reverse jinx. But Mark, thank you so much for your question. And that will do it for this PO Sox. Thank you to everyone that submitted questions. If you would like to submit a question or topic on a future episode of the Sox Machine podcast, the best way of doing it, because again, we're getting so many questions from our Patreon supporters, is to become a Patreon supporter yourself by going to patreon.com/SoxMachine, where we have several different tiers of support, starting at $2 a month, $3 a month, $5 a month, and $10 a month, which you get a ad-free version of the podcast, you get an ad-free version of the website, you get exclusive content, and you get first crack at any new Sox Machine swag items that come about. So again, if you enjoy our work and you want more, go to patreon.com/SoxMachine and sign up today. And that will do it for this Sox Machine podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. We hope you have a great Memorial Day. And if you just discovered the Sox Machine podcast, you can subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And the Sox Machine podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball. Alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.